Lynn Turner.
Some observations. First, as an audit committee chair, I do get the hour breakdown on the audits where I chair the audit committees by staffing level. And the partner hours are a higher percentage now than what I was accustomed to a half dozen years or so ago, although they're not significantly higher. So it's moving in the right direction. Probably still not enough movement in that direction, though probably could still go a fair amount more. And I've had a number of occasions where I've turned around and asked the audit partner about particular things on different audits and risk areas, and the audit partner will real quickly say, hey, why don't I have the audit manager answer that for you? And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or to figure out why that question is directed to the audit manager, and it has certainly caught my attention and given me the ability to then go back and grill the audit partner. Usually the next time back, the audit partner knows the answer. But I'm still not sure we're getting the hours out of the top person. And considering you've just done an AS5 that says, in essence, the key to any successful audit there is to be able to do a top-down risk assessment. We've got a proven track record of not doing real well on that in this industry. If you don't adjust the current standard to make sure that those hours at the hours that go into making that assessment, if they don't come from that partner more so than what they have in the past, you aren't going to get a top-down risk-based audit. You just aren't going to do it. And that shows up in some of the reports that we've seen over the last year, especially over the last in 2007 at Glass Lewis. We have been able to pick up a number of filings where we just look through the filing and find that the accounting has been done wrong. Call up the company. The company's traditional answer is, I cleared it with my partner, and my partner guarantees me it's absolutely right. And we put out a report, and within a short period of time, weeks, if not a month or two, there's a restatement coming through on that issue. And I think this goes back to Ernie's question of, it's not only about the staff down below the partner, but it's the partner. Are we getting the right people on these audits? And when someone out in Broomfield, Colorado can pick up a public filing, not once, not twice, but a number of times, and find errors in it just by reading the filing, it tells you that there's still something not right about that, either competency-wise or training-wise, because it's not one. It's the senior missed it, the manager missed it, and at least two partners missed it. And when I look at the inspection reports, we have seen inspection reports time after time come out of this body that cite some pretty significant misses that you wonder how someone could miss those if everyone was on top of it. And back to Joe's point, I go back and go through those inspection reports and say, what was missing? What happened that went wrong? Is it a performance issue? If it's a performance issue, then I'm severely disappointed in the PCLB inspection or enforcement process, because we ain't seen no enforcement. And it's just non-existent, especially among the big top six firms. It just, cases haven't been there. If it's not performance, then it's got to be in the standard. And you ought to be able to come back and tell us then, based upon what you've seen in your inspections, what's wrong with the standard. And it's not just the standard, perhaps more important, is what's in the firm's own guidance manuals themselves, because usually the firm's own guidance manuals in this area are much better than any standard that the standard setters have ever written, and they're just really good. And so I say part, if there's a problem, the part of the process has to be, what is it that you would change in the firm's own manuals, and I'd actually start there before I'd start with the auditing standard, because I think those manuals are just, for the most part, the ones that I've seen are just exceptionally good. And why don't you have performance with those manuals? And that comes out of the inspection process. But your inspections, and part of this is quality control, so we don't see it. We aren't supposed to see it unless it's not a corrected problem. We haven't seen anything in enforcement or anything, so I assume any problems have been corrected. So there's kind of a bit of a disconnect between what we're seeing in the inspection reports and then people saying there's not a problem.
Howard Johnson.
Well, I think it's good to bring these things up proactively. My opinion, I don't think this area is broken, but it's good to bring it up and surface it. And Lynn said what I was going to say a lot. The other thing that's happened is the audit committees are, from my observations, increasingly looking at the caliber of the audit team, the entirety of it. Obviously, they're very involved in selecting who the new engagement partner will be, but also the entire team and the level of detail that's required these days, my observations, as to who's going to be on the team when they present the plan and the type of comments that are directed to the individual members of the audit team is to test their knowledge, see how much they really know what's going on within that company they're auditing, has really increased in the last several years. So you have to take that type of thing, which, there's been more requirements about the audit committee being more actively managing the public accounting firm. You have to take that into account here, too.
Ben Coleman.
I guess just to briefly, I am supportive of the vast majority of what was said here with respect to, is there really a problem? But I just really do caution against trying to be very prescriptive in who does what, giving, I guess, the scalability point that was made there all the way to, we've got the engagements as Bob said, where we've got many, many partners on the engagements and very complex teams and, specialty people and special skill sets. And I'd encourage you to think more in terms of skill set than title. And I'd also encourage you, instead of very similar to, I think, what John was saying, for some reason we seem to be going to this standard versus the quality more appropriately should be determined in the quality control standards. So I'm just wondering why this conversation's here, because it's more appropriate in the quality control standards.
Jeff Steinhoff.
I think Joe, when he began this session, and Lynn summed it up well, you do have a very important tool in the fact that you've got all these inspections. And I think really making a determination, is this a standards issue or an execution issue or a competency issue? And the audit firm is responsible for doing a quality job. And if you're finding as part of the inspection process or finding by a prevalence of restatements or other problems that they are not doing a quality job, then you have to get behind that and determine why. And there could be a variety of reasons for it. But what I'm hearing today, and it kind of sets forth with my own belief, is that I think people aren't seeing it so much as the standard, but it's how one carries out the standard. So if you can really focus in on those inspections and where are the areas where it's not being done properly, and is there a need for guidance in certain areas? And maybe guidance is really the way to go in some of this.
Bob Kippers.
I guess just quickly, but listening to the last few comments, and Lynn in his own way has raised a very interesting point. Ben mentioned quality control standards. Maybe that's where this kind of thing should reside. But I think what it comes down to is, at the end of the day, when there's a problem and there is an enforcement matter and action, performance issues historically, in at least our experience with the SEC enforcement regime, individual performance meant a case against the person, whether it's the partner or somebody at another level. If the firm itself had something more systemic that was wrong, then the firm would be at risk for enforcement action. And as I listen to all of this, quality control standards mean that the procedures, the manuals, the training, you know, that's the responsibility of the firm as an organization. Performance issues by people not following that guidance and not stepping up to their responsibilities as prescribed, that's a little different issue. So to me, this is just fascinating because in the PCOB realm, we don't really know what the rules are yet. We don't have a body of history here. But I think it requires the board and the staff to give a lot of consideration as to whether guidance in this area should reside in the QC standards or in the audit standards, because I think you have a different outcome when you hold people accountable at the end of the day.
Jeff Sahel.
I wanted to comment on something Bob just said that I might be taking this out of context. I guess I believe that the responsibility for not following a given firm policy, organization policy, rests not just with the partner or team that hasn't followed it, but it ultimately rests with the organization. So I would ratchet everything up and say the organization, the firm, is responsible for making sure that they have partners, managers all the way down the line in place that understand the firm policies and procedures, that follow them, and that raise any issues as they come due with a policy or process or procedure they cannot follow. So I think in an ultimate sense, one must place the onus on the audit firm to ensure that their partners are properly trained all the way down the line and they're following all the practices, policies, and procedures. Now, the PCOB comes in and does its inspection as, I view it as a secondary inspection. But the firm has the ultimate responsibility, and if one finds that these practice or policies, the partner didn't do a good job, or the manager's all the way down, I would say the organization should be the one responsible, in addition to the partner. I'm not sure that's what I got policy the partner, but maybe I'm wrong.
Sorry, just a follow-up. I'm already regretting I even raised this issue. I do agree with you, but I think the truth is that if there's a problem on an individual audit, it's very fact-dependent. I mean, you can have a great system. You have a great culture. You could have great tone, good reinforcement, good internal and external inspections, and still have a situation where somebody, you know, flies off the reservation, and I don't think it's automatic that the firm should be subjected to an enforcement action. I think that should be fact-dependent. But as a philosophy, I agree that the leadership of the firm, you know, owns the need for quality and has to instill that throughout the ranks. I don't doubt that at all.
Bill Messier?
Wasn't sure you were going to let me talk, Tom. I said I didn't have it. I wasn't going to state my opinion. I think there are probably points in the standard-setting process where you may want to be specific. And I think the one that makes sense to me is the one that's already there, the notion that the partner ought to participate in brainstorming. I mean, I think if you think about that, I mean, I suspect most firms have that in their standards, but I could think of examples where the partner just says, all right, you guys go ahead and have this meeting and tell me what happened later on. And in that case, all of that cumulative knowledge that partner has about that engagement might be lost. So I think I'm generally rule-based, but I can think of a couple of exceptions to where I would put this information into the standards. That's my 2 cents.
This is actually a good topic to move on to some of our other discussion questions. The people who had the 10 cards up, feel free to leave them up. As we're going to the performing the audit, we had a couple other topics that we wanted to put on the table. The first one is whether the auditing standards should direct the senior member or the members of the engagement team to be directly involved in the higher risk areas of the audit, such as risk assessment, fraud risk analysis, and other aspects of the audit that involve analysis of complex issues or the extensive use of professional judgment And then also whether the auditing standards should define or outline specific roles for the auditors at each level of the engagement team. And finally, on a topic that's already had a few comments, whether special consideration should be given to audit engagements that are based on the size and complexity of the issuer being audited or the size of the accounting firm. Joe Carcello?
Well, I'll make a comment about this, and then I'll address my other comment. I think these questions are similar to what we've been talking about already. So to specify that the audit partner has to do some of these tasks and to provide no flexibility for specific circumstances, I think would probably be a mistake. It's hard to disagree that the audit partner should be involved in considering fraud risk. I think that's pretty obvious. But imagine a situation where the audit partner had responsibility for assessing fraud risk, but if a senior manager on the engagement was a CPA, CFE, and had prior experience with the FBI, wouldn't he or she be a better fit to take the lead role? At the end of the day, the partner is responsible. But in that particular case, the senior manager may just have better expertise, and it may make sense for him or her to take the lead role there. The second point that I make, which is not really teed up in any of your questions, but I'm just curious if you've even batted around a discussion of this. We're talking about engagement team performance, and Lynn correctly points out situations where he's sitting in Broomfield, Colorado, and recognizes problems with published financial statements, and then you kind of question, how does that happen? So at the end of the day, I think the real concern here is, how do you make engagement teams perform better? And one thing that I know has happened in some foreign countries, I'm far from an expert on this, so others may know more, but in some foreign countries, the partner has to sign his or her name alongside the firm's signature. And if you look at the behavioral literature, there's some evidence to suggest that that additional level of personable accountability, public accountability, has an effect. And so what would be interesting to look at, and again, I don't know if you guys have the capabilities to do this, but again, you always have the ability to commission research. Is there any evidence that when foreign jurisdictions change the regime from a situation where the partner didn't sign his or her name to where they did, is there any evidence that audit quality improved? And if there's evidence that audit quality improved, then it's probably worth thinking about here in the U.S. If there's no evidence that audit quality improved, then you probably let the idea drop.
Lynn Turner.
On the second question about based on size and all, I think the answer is yes. I think there is a big difference between auditing a General Electric and the skill sets that it takes amongst the engagement team to audit that type of multinational, broad-based company versus someone that's auditing a $50 million, $20 million a year company. It's just different. And the skill sets and the coordination and the administration and the ability to keep it together on those two are different. Sometimes it's a small company that's harder, and sometimes it's a large company. But I actually don't think engagement teams move back and forth in between those two environments all that well. I think we saw some of that in the first year of the internal control testing. People weren't able to move up and down in company size and tailor it the way it should be. So I think this needs to be dealt with. Maybe the best place to deal with it is in the firm's own manuals themselves. But I think there has to be recognition if you got two different skill sets when you're managing the audits of those two different size companies. They just aren't the same, and the issues and the complexities dramatically. I would certainly agree with or tee up the issue Joe has. I personally think that it does make a difference from a behavioral aspect, and that's really what we're talking about here, because we're talking about performance, if a partner had to put their own name on the report or not. And I think if any partner had a qualm about putting their own name on a report, they ought to be thinking about whether they're willing to sign with the firm's name. And I'd certainly encourage you to think about that, and I'm a firm believer the firm partner ought to be willing and should put their name on a report to investors.
Wes Williams.
I agree with the statement Lynn made, but I have a little different take on it. But I think the audit standards need to be scalable based on the size and complexity of the entity, but not based so much on the size of the audit firm itself. I want to pick up on a theme that's kind of come through here. We have to look at the competency of the audit teams and the competencies of the firm itself. And I think these are already accepted by the board, the quality control standards they've adopted, which address both the firm competencies as well as the partner charge competencies. So it kind of goes back to this whole theme of getting the right person on the right job.
Bob Tertullo.
Thanks, Bill. Just on the point that Joe and Lynn were making about the psychological difference between signing one's personal name and signing a firm's name, I used to sign audit opinions in the name of a firm, and now I'm certifying financial statements under SOX in my personal name. And I would like to believe it wouldn't make a difference, but it does. It's psychologically different.
I'm in an organization where we sign our own name. And if I'm signing my own name, I check everything over 100 times. And if I'm sending it up for the Comptroller General to sign his name, I check it over 200 times. I think it does make a difference. Although, I don't think for any one moment that signing a firm name means that the partners that are doing that aren't trying to do a very good job, because the firm name is very important to them. So I'm not sure at what level it makes a difference. And I think they still bring that professional pride, and they still feel they're responsible and accountable for it.
Vin Coleman?
Yeah, I didn't want to let that go without. I mean, I appreciate those final comments, because I it may affect behavior. I don't know. I haven't done a study, and I have no idea. And I understand there's some common practices in Europe and whatever. But I can assure you, I mean, I've been signing opinions for 25 years. And when you're signing that opinion, all right, part of it's your firm, but part of it is if there's an issue, I mean, everyone knows who signs that opinion. Look at any enforcement release. Look at, you know, when there is an issue, okay, even a PCAOB review, it's very clear who is responsible for the work that is performed, ultimately responsible for the work performed on that engagement. And so to say that, you know, writing it will have a significant change in an engagement partner's behavior, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, it may, but I would tell you, I think you'd be not fully understanding, I think, particularly in the last 5 years. I mean, as Randy said, there's been a significant change in the last 5 years with respect to the accountability, with respect to what the engagement partners, you know, feel and do. And I just don't want that to be go unsaid.
Jeff Rosello?
Yeah, I agree with Vince, and I don't want anyone to misinterpret. I think the overwhelming majority of partners take their responsibility of signing the firm's name very, very seriously. All I was suggesting is that it might be worth thinking about, and to the extent that there is data available on foreign countries, it might be worth considering. But I'm not suggesting for a moment that most partners are signing the firm's name without being very comfortable that they're doing the right thing.
Any other comments? I know, Randy, you had your tech card up at one point and put it back down.
Only because Bob Kipper has raised the issue of quality control, which he regrets. I have to comment also. I think in this whole era, when we talk about what an audit partner or the lead partner is responsible for, you do have to have that in a large firm, there are quality control systems in place, and that partner should be able to rely on those, or else we will have very inefficient systems. So when it comes to in a large firm and coordinating a large audit around the world, you know, you can't expect that lead partner to have been responsible for training of everyone who's on that team, which you could do if you were in a very small firm doing a handful of audits. So I just sometimes, no one is saying the lead partner is not, in a sense, very responsible for that audit opinion that he signs either internally or, you know, on an opinion that would have the firm's name also. But you really do have to allow that partner to rely on the firm's quality control system around many things like independence, like training, like competency, or you just couldn't have each person do it. So I would just keep that in mind as you start looking at the one-hand prescription. That's a concern I have for actually, John, when you read Isaiah. You can read that and say, this sounds like the partner's supposed to do all this, and sometimes the firm does it. And to your point, Jeff, at the end of the day, both the firm and the partner are going to be held responsible if there's a problem. So you might as well.
Any other comments? Oh, Savannah? So repeating this issue to death, I'll just add in one more thought. And that's from the perspective of the users and, in particular, investors in the marketplace. And one of the aspects of that I had always thought with the firm name being on the opinion was that's what it meant from a user perspective. The investors cared that it was the firm. So another model has to actually ask what's the usefulness of that information to the marketplace also. Lynn Turner?
I'd turn around and challenge you on that, Silvana. We turned around and
it,
we
it
said...
It wouldn't be the first time Lynn has challenged me on something.
And I can guarantee it probably won't be the last either.
So can I.
We sit here and we tell public companies it makes a difference to them. They used to sign with the general sign-off page on a 10-K and on the Qs, and now we've got them doing this very specific certification, and all the firms sitting around the table here supported those CEOs and CFO having to certify to the accuracy of the financial statements. I find it somewhat astounding that firms would say for public companies and for a CEO and CFO, they absolutely got to do this because we need their butt on the line and it does make a difference to them. But for us as audit partners, oh, it really doesn't make a difference. We'll do it. That's just unfathomable. You think people act two different ways like that. And I think absolutely if we're going to force the CEO and CFO to put their name on the line, then we ought to be turning around and putting the audit partner's name on the line. And if they got a problem with doing that, then I, as an investor, I do want to know that because that does give me informational content.
Savannah? Well, I think the question is not whether your name is on the line or not. It's what it means and the mechanism by which it occurs. So it's different. It's important to recognize these are two different settings and what a signature means and what it signals. And as all I'm suggesting, Lynn, is it's probably important to think about the signaling aspect of this, not just laying your signature on the line per se. Damon Silvers?
Well, I found this last exchange very informative because I was sitting there listening trying to figure out what is this debate about? And now I know. Because it seemed to me that the sort of issues that were teed up here were ones that it'd be very difficult. If people aren't doing their jobs, they don't understand what they are and so forth, how are you going to write a standard that's going to fix that? And is it really true that they don't understand what their jobs are? And I'm just completely baffled by it. But now I understand what it's about. It's about whether or not you sign the person's name and the firm's name, or just the person's name or just the firm's name. And it strikes me that really this can't possibly be something people are seriously arguing about. It is useful from the perspective of investors, and not just from a punitive kind of approach, but from an informative approach to have both. And the signaling is that A, there is a firm here, and that the person who is signing it is signing it with the full backing and support of which investor can rely upon the firm and its own procedures and philosophies, and that there is an actual human being that one could, if one wanted to, talk to about what this means. That strikes me as sort of plain and simple, and shouldn't be that terribly controversial. But again, I thought I was missing something for a while. Maybe I'm still missing something.
Sir Carcello.
There's another potential benefit of having the partner sign that just occurred to me. There's pretty extensive literature in academia on expertise. So it was alluded to this morning by Bill Messier. And the earlier work on expertise basically found that firms that do more work in a particular industry do higher quality audits. But as everyone knows, audits are done by audit teams, even though the firm signs it. And some more recent work done primarily by Jerry Francis and some of his colleagues looks at the quality at the local office level and finds that there's higher quality if the local office has more industry expertise in whatever the industry is of a particular client. The really interesting question would be, is the quality higher, and as we would presume it would be, if the engagement team, primarily the partner, had more industry expertise. If partners had to sign, it wouldn't take very long, and there'd be a database of every public company, at least, that they serve. And you could start measuring expertise at the individual partner level in industries, and then you could track whether or not that translated into higher audit quality.
Again, like Damon, maybe I'm starting to understand this issue, and maybe I'm not. But I want to reflect back to a point that Bob Kippers made. So I'm glad he's here because I want to make sure that I'm understanding. And I don't mean to be critical of his point, but I think you raised the point, which I think is very important, about the idea that once in a while it's possible that an audit partner can get off the reservation with respect to his or her firm. And if so, what's the responsibility of the firm? How do we build mechanisms to minimize the likelihood that that could happen? Right? So apropos our discussion about how many people we're going to have sign this report, one possibility would be to think about the idea that the partner is signing the report on his or her behalf as well as the firm's, but that the concurring partner also could sign, representing that the firm's quality controls are in place and that the concurring partner is really signing on behalf of the firm almost against the partner. That's a very provocative idea, so it probably isn't worth much, but we have 6 minutes, and I thought I'd say something.
Sam Rentilla.
Well, I have no idea what we're talking about now. But, I can't speak for all of my audit partners. I surely can't speak for any that aren't in my firm, but I can speak for myself, and I can tell you unequivocally that when I signed KPMG, and if I signed my name below it, it would make no difference. It would not change my behavior in one iota if my name went underneath KPMG, and I believe that most of my partners feel the same way. The answer, Dick's interesting. I was trying to give some context around the quality control system. I think it's important to keep in mind that any quality control system has a cost-benefit relationship, just like a company's internal control system cannot, from a cost-benefit perspective, ever support absolute assurance around the quality of the information. And the same is true with our system. So we have built, again, I can only speak for my firm, we believe we've built a quality control system that provides reasonable assurance about the quality of our audits. Does that mean we are going to be 100% accurate, that we will never have some audit issue? Absolutely not. And we could do that. We get out financial statements within a decade, and there would be no problems with that. But that would be the kind of, that's the counterbalance, just like a company goes through when they look at their internal controls, they make cost-benefit analysis. The same thing is true with respect to quality control systems at accounting firms.
Galen Hansen.
I appreciate your comments, Sam, and I'm the same way. When I sign my firm name, I mean, it means something to me. But I think most of the people sitting around this table and the people that we deal with that feel that way. Also, unfortunately, there's others out there that it might mean more if they were signing their personal name. And I think the concept merits maybe exploration by the board. I wanted to talk also, Ben mentioned we always know who does what on the audit. Some of you know that I'm involved with state boards, and we also have disciplinary matters. And it's really interesting when firms get in trouble and we bring them in, and we see a lot of finger-pointing. You know, I only did this, or, you know, that person was responsible for that. And, you know, I think a certain minimum level of who is doing what might make some sense at some level anyway, because that should never happen. We should always know who's responsible, and the individuals involved should know what their responsibilities are.
Craig Olmstead.
I'd just like to comment regarding Ben's earlier comment. I can tell you, as a CFO who has to sign financials, I have never yet had the view that the engagement partner should also have to sign. And I would tell you that candidly, I mean, my own view is that this conversation is really a discussion of form over substance.
Leroy Dennis.
I just want to point out, and again, I can't, like Sam, I can't speak for everybody. Every firm's quality control procedures. As it relates to signing the report, I agree it would make no difference in how I sign an opinion. And I also would point out that if you go into our methodology, there are literally hundreds of places where every engagement person on the team signs. They initial every work paper. They sign each section twice. They sign an overall quality control review forms. They sign off on significant adjustments that are passed. They sign off on internal control areas and an overall conclusion. So there is umpteen places in a file where people sign. I don't think adding one more to the 10K makes a big difference.
Galen, did you have anything else? Sure. Well, thank you very much for the insightful discussion we've just had for the last 75 minutes. I also want to thank Bill Messier for coming and presenting his thoughts on the subject area. And I will now turn it over to Tom.
Thanks. We actually had the benefit of discussing two topics in that time slot quite thoroughly, I think. So that's quite good. Thanks, Bill. We do appreciate your willingness to come join us today. We're going to break for lunch. We're going to return at 2. We do have lunch for the members of the SAG, the official observers, board members, and members of the PCAOB staff upstairs, I think. Is that correct? Yes.